This week on the Allegheny Front, we're going back to school to see what kids are learning about the environment from climate change.
It's really unfair to not teach kids the accurate science.
To how people relate to the wider world.
If I can affect something negatively, I can also affect it equally positively.
I'm Kara Holsoppel. When the bell rings, we're not done yet. There's after-school nature drawing and putting kids to work battling invasive species. Those and more environmental stories about kids are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. How and what do kids learn about climate change at school? A survey published in the journal Science earlier this year showed that most middle and high school science teachers spend little time teaching climate science, just an hour or two a year. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant wanted to find out how this plays out in Pennsylvania. She has this story.
Craig Wipke isn't always the most popular guy at Central Valley High School, about 30 miles northwest of Pittsburgh in Beaver County. He teaches environmental science in this old steel region and gets called tree hugger a lot. Just a few weeks ago, after he took students on a field trip to an environmental center,
I had a student come up to me and the young lady informed me that her dad was coming to pick her up, but would I mind going somewhere else because her dad didn't like me very much.
Wipke's gotten used to it. Nearly 10 years ago, when he started teaching high school science, he trained with Al Gore's Climate Reality Project. He brought the climate science back to his students, and some of them started talking about it at home. One parent, a leader in the local Republican Party, even wrote an editorial in the Beaver County Times complaining about Wipke. That's when higher-ups in the Central Valley School District took notice. They called him in to review his lesson plans.
I was a second-year teacher, and I was teaching a brand-new course, and the school board and the administration wanted to take a look at my materials. Absolutely. I was sweating.
And Wipke's not alone. Other Pennsylvania science teachers have been challenged for teaching climate change. Many times it becomes an issue when a district is ordering new textbooks. Just last month, members of the Quakertown Area School Board, north of Philadelphia, refused to order the environmental science and oceanography books requested by the district's administration. They didn't like that students would be taught climate change as a scientific fact. Quakertown board members declined to talk with us for this story, but something similar happened in the Saucon Valley School District, south of Allentown. Brian Eichfeld, a school board member there, calls climate change a hoax and a political issue. He wants textbooks that provide competing views.
That's not what's happening with climate change. They are taking everything they can to prove that there's climate change and ignoring the data that disproves it.
Science teachers in Eichfeld's own district and at the national level say there is no other side. This isn't politics, it's science based on data and evidence. Minda Burbeco is policy director with the National Center for Science Education. She takes issue when school board members call the lack of balance unfair.
You know, it's really unfair to not teach kids the accurate science. It's really unfair to not demonstrate what the evidence shows and what the data shows.
Burbeco says when school boards choose science textbooks, they're really deciding how students will understand climate change. For example, researchers surveyed 4 middle school science textbooks in California, and they found a lot of wishy-washy language.
It depicts scientists as unsure. So scientists think, not evidence shows or research has shown. Students come away with a real misunderstanding of climate change. They think that scientists are unsure about it. They think that there's a controversy.
And beyond textbooks, many teachers don't know enough about climate change themselves and don't really feel confident teaching it. David Evans is director of the National Association of Teachers. He says the average teacher graduated in the 1990s.
And honestly, 20 years ago, climate science, in fact, probably most environmental science, was not very heavily featured in teacher preparation programs.
Plus, in Pennsylvania, the incentive is low. Many states have passed new science standards that include climate change, but not Pennsylvania. And the biology Keystone exam, a test that teachers must prepare students to take, doesn't really address climate change either. Teacher Craig Wipke, that tree hugger in western Pennsylvania, says there are plenty of reasons teachers choose to skip climate change.
I think it is don't rock the boat. I think it's the easiest path. I think it is, however you want to put it, it doesn't get a lot of press that it's not in there, but it would get a lot of press if it was in there.
Wipke says it's too bad because young people will need to understand climate change to make informed decisions in the future. Still, he's optimistic. He says the superintendent and the school board members who gave him trouble when he first started teaching climate science 10 years ago have all been replaced. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
While students' exposure to the topic of climate change might be lacking, other environmental initiatives in the classroom are moving along swimmingly. 7 Pittsburgh area classrooms have 20-gallon fish tanks, but they're not housing class pets. They're aquaponic systems dedicated to raising fish and plants and a new generation of excited scientists. Margaret J. Krause has more.
Until a couple of weeks ago, the only species available for observation at Propel Andrew Street High School in Munhall, near Pittsburgh, was the typical American teenager. Jaden Scapletto points out some new arrivals.
So we have our tank on the bottom with a few fish, and then we have a pump that pumps water through the top, which has pods of these rock doodler thingies that have plants inside of them.
Those rock thingies contain what will eventually be spinach, set in a tray above the tank. The plants feed on the goldfish waste being pumped up from a pair cruising down below. Scapletto says the class tank used to hold more fish.
Ours only has 2 now because one of them died because it got stuck to the pump and couldn't get off.
Some of the things that happen with the system, there's going to be a lot of troubleshooting. There's going to be a lot of unexpected outcomes. But the kids are now scientists.
That's Quincy Kofi Swatson. He founded Pittsburgh nonprofit The Door Campaign. At the time, he didn't have any money, but he did have dreadlocks.
We had VIP sponsors pay $100 to cut off one of my locks.
Swatson used the funding to create a pilot class that teaches high school students about aquaponics. But why aquaponics? Why fish?
We use fish as a tool to engage our students in science, technology, engineering, and math.
His program meets current science education requirements, such as Pennsylvania Common Core and Next Generation Science Standards. But more importantly, says Swatson, the class pummels students' preconceptions about their own abilities.
I want to enforce the idea that they are scientists, that they are great, that they are intelligent, and if they want to pursue a career in science, technology, engineering, and math, it's not that far from them.
Swatson can relate. He grew up in one of Pittsburgh's lower-income neighborhoods and feels like he got lucky.
I was exposed to a lot of different things through external programs from the school that helped cultivate and activate my success and my potential.
When he was in high school, Swatson was introduced to both aquaponics and conservation. He remembers learning about how his actions, like tossing a bag of chips on the ground, affected the environment. For most people, that might have been a prescriptive experience. I must not litter. But for Swatson, it was something more.
I learned that if I can affect something negatively, I can also affect it equally positively. Once I had that ownership, the sky's the limit.
And that's what he hopes kids learn from managing the aquaponics system. They're in control, not just of the fish and the plants, but of the impact they can make with their lives. If you haven't been in a high school classroom lately, says teacher Kristen Tavnar, don't let the sounds of chaos fool you.
These kids are thinking deeply and they're questioning and they are caring for an environment, making sure it's pH balanced. So they're engaging in a lot of scientific concepts.
Melvin Johnson sits right up front, closest to the tanks.
I like doing experiments, seeing things react to other things.
For China Hickman Hill, aquaponics made her think about how things work.
People usually think life is just something that happened. Everything happens just because. But it's kind of cool to see how things happen and why it happens, so it kind of helps you with life more. I feel like I can make a cause and a change effect just because I know what's happening in it.
The class is in the first of a 3-year pilot program, and like the aquaponic systems themselves, Swatson says, the curriculum can only prove itself over time.
We want to plant seeds now. We can't harvest it the next day. We have to wait. We have to invest.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
Thank you.
environment in schools isn't just about lesson plans. What about the school buildings themselves or the neighborhoods where they're located? The group Healthy Schools Pennsylvania says kids can be exposed to a lot of environmental toxins at school. Michelle Nakareti-Chapkis is executive director of Women for a Healthy Environment, which runs the Healthy Schools program. I talked with her about some of the dangers in schools and solutions.
There are a whole host of environmental factors in a school building that folks might not be familiar with. Things like lead in paint, radon in schools, the types of products that are used in schools for maintenance and operations, such as cleaning supplies, as well as things like pesticides that are used on the school grounds. Our buildings are aging, 40 to 50 year old buildings, school buildings across the United States, and we know that nearly 50 million students, 6 million adults are stepping foot into these buildings. One in six Americans steps foot into a school building every day. And with this infrastructure, we need to make an investment. You know, that's a funding issue too. There was a report that just came out this year. It's the State of Our Schools, which came out a couple of weeks ago. It showed that the historic spending for K to 12 facilities was at $99 billion, that the modern standards to bring that up to today's standards would be $145 billion, which would basically leave a projected gap of $46 billion for K to 12 facilities to really upgrade. We have product in our school buildings that we know aren't safe, but have been used traditionally in years past, such as asbestos. And PCBs have been used in the lighting fixtures in buildings. So these carcinogenic products are still in our buildings. And now with our aging infrastructure, we need to address that and renovate these spaces to make them healthier.
Are there studies that you've looked at that link kids' health or performance in school to environmental issues at their school buildings or where those buildings are located?
The scientific evidence is pointing more toward demonstrating how we can create that green and healthy environment by reducing these environmental toxins on a daily basis. If we keep those buildings healthy, then we're keeping all of the people in those buildings healthy. And as a result, then we have less absenteeism rates. We have students in the seats who then lead to better learning and better achievement and academic performance. So for instance, we can use green cleaning as an example. It's an issue that our organization has been working on a while now. And there are lots of studies that have been done that show that by switching to a third-party certified green cleaning product, a product that has been screened and tested for safety, by utilizing those products in a school building, that it does certainly reduce any asthma triggers, allergy triggers, et cetera, that really creates a better environment for all of those, including custodial staff.
So instead of like chlorine-based products, more naturally based products.
Right. Plant-based products, more moving toward things like hydrogen peroxide as a base, as opposed to traditional antibacterial, antimicrobial products. Oftentimes when we have these commercial as well as consumer-grade products that we purchase, we don't know of all of the ingredients. Studies have been done that show that ingredients in cleaning products that are used still in schools contain things like asthmogens, which are triggers for asthma, or carcinogens. And so we want people to move toward another type of product that is comparatively priced to traditional products and works just as effectively, if not better, than products that are traditionally used in the school buildings.
One of your initiatives is the Healthy Schools Map, where you're looking at environmental hazards that are nearby schools, not in schools, but neighborhoods where the schools are located. And I was kind of struck by the fact that 61% of school districts in southwestern Pennsylvania have one or more air emission sources within a one-mile radius of the school building. I guess maybe we shouldn't be so surprised in southwestern Pennsylvania, but, you know, that's not necessarily something that we can change. But how should schools deal with these risks?
It's a good question. When we did our mapping initiative, we looked at various environmental factors within a one-mile radius of school buildings and found air emission sources, as well as gas wells, compressor stations, active mining operations, and active railroads. And that's certainly a concern these days with the derailments that we've been seeing in the news over the last couple of years, especially the trains that are carrying crude oil. What we can do is to use that information for emergency preparedness and response. Also use it in terms of siting of new schools and proper planning of schools. We certainly don't want to construct a new school within that buffer zone that we're describing of the 1 mile, as well as the school building itself and the facility directors and staff, so that they are familiar and are working through their HVAC system, for instance, of changing filters, looking at the intakes, the outtakes in those buildings so that they're reducing these exposures. And air quality action days. If we have an air quality action day, it's an opportunity to really think about having those kids out on the playground at recess. It might not be a day that it's healthy for them to be outside, even though our skies are blue.
Is Pennsylvania doing enough at the state level to help address these issues with schools?
We could be doing better. And the organization, Healthy Schools PA, is working at the state level to talk with our legislators about policies that would better protect the health of the school community. There are 11 states in DC that have passed green cleaning and school bills, and we think that makes good sense for Pennsylvania to follow. We also have been talking with legislators about radon in schools. We have many states that have passed bills that require radon testing once every 5 years. We have testing of our homes when we have a home transfer, but we don't have that of our schools. And we really need to be focusing on radon, as we know, a contributor to lung cancer. It's a second leading cause of lung cancer in the U.S.
You know, crumbling buildings are kind of an obvious sign that a school might not be safe, but probably a lot of parents aren't familiar with, for example, integrated pest management, which is something that your organization looks at and pays attention to in schools. So what should parents look for when it comes to environmental safety in their child's school?
We have laws in Pennsylvania, such as anti-idling laws for buses, that ensure that buses don't idle any longer than a period of 5 minutes in a 1 hour in a 60-minute time period. But we know oftentimes that's getting overlooked. So parents can be that strong voice to say, turn off the engine. We have an IPM law in Pennsylvania. However,
IPM is integrated pest management.
See,
I didn't even know that.
The acronyms, right? Integrated pest management, yes. And so schools then have to post and notify the school community when they're going to be applying that pesticide application. Again, this is an opportunity for parents to work with that school district to really understand why that spraying has to occur. Is it more of a preventative nature? Or is it something that is addressing a specific problem?
Michelle Nacoretti-Chapkis is with Healthy Schools Pennsylvania. They recently recognized 8 Pennsylvania schools which are taking steps to protect their students and staff from environmental risks. You can learn more about that at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. She liked being out with her friends at the mall, tagging them on Instagram. But hanging out on a hiking trail? No.
Many of us haven't been to the park or any green areas around the city for years.
Coming up on the Allegheny Front, one teenager gets in touch with her green side through volunteering and surprises herself. Don't miss it. After a long day at school, some kids like to go home, put their feet up, and watch TV. But at the Kingsley Association Center in Pittsburgh's Larimer neighborhood, they're getting in touch with their local environment instead, through the LUNA program.
Learning urban nature through art.
That's environmental artist Anne Rosenthal. And with partners like Penn State Extension's 4-H program, she's guiding kids through their urban landscape with drawing and painting. First, though, they have to research plants and trace their lines and curves onto paper. When I visited, every kid I asked there said they love to draw. That day, Rosenthal was projecting the kids' initial drawings onto larger sheets of paper taped to a wall.
So you're just tracing around all your shapes.
These larger pieces will be made into posters for a public art show. 12-year-old Naya Lance has a big smile on her face because she discovers her drawing is first to be worked on, larger than life in front of everyone.
There are 4 different flowers, but the main one is a black-eyed Susan. It's the yellow one.
What's something that you've learned here that you didn't know before you started?
I didn't know that pollinators could be birds as well as bees. They carry nectar from flower to flower. It's like what they do to save flowers.
She carefully moves a black permanent marker around the giant paper, making the leaves and stems pop. Rosenthal helps, dotting her marker to fill in the centers where the petals meet.
Okay, I think we're done.
What do you think?
I like it.
Ooh, yep, now can nice. We take the tape off?
Yep, now can we like do it? That?
Later, I visited Rosenthal in her Pittsburgh studio to find out more about the LUNA program. I asked the kids this question, so I'm going to ask you, what's been your favorite part of going to the center and working with them?
What I love to see is kids fully engaged, fully present and concentrated on what they're doing. I started taking botanical art classes maybe about 5 years ago. And one of the things I love is it totally consumes you. When you're looking at this plant or this image of a plant, and you're looking at every detail and nuance and trying to figure out like how the leaves, what kind of edges they have, you're like in another world, that state of flow that is sometimes talked about. When I see kids in that state, that makes me really happy. I feel like I've hit the mark.
I read on your website that a goal of the program is to create eco-literacy. So I'm just wondering what that is and why it's important to you and also the students.
Well, eco-literacy is an understanding of the natural world. And in particular, for me, it has to do with systems thinking. Our educational system, the way it has evolved, everything is in its own little box. You know, you've got science, you've got art, you've got literature, and there's no connecting them. But in the real world, it's all mixed up and it's all connected. And I think that's become a big problem today, the lack of systems thinking, because the problems that we're facing, the environmental problems and the social problems and how they interrelate, in order to address those issues and solve them, you need to draw on a lot of different disciplines and from a lot of different sources. And so I think that systems thinking is really important. Like when we talk about pollinators and their relationship to the plants, that's a very small but very intricate and interesting system. And maybe just that one little idea, if they walk away with that one little idea, it'll spark their thinking about, well, how do other things connect?
Talk about what the kids are actually working on and what they're working towards.
Kingsley Association is a real kind of focal point and center in the community, and said, well, the community would like to know more about what plants and trees are best suited in the urban environment where they live. What should they be planting that would be right for, you know, more native habitat and those kinds of things? So Luna, the first session is learning about the plants and pollinators and doing drawings. And then the drawings are going to be used in the summer session to create banners that will go up in the neighborhood. And then in the fall, the plan is for the kids to, again, use these drawings, and maybe they'll have to do some other research to create a planting guide for the community.
What are the kids' attitudes or knowledge when they start, when they came in, and where do you want them to end up, or where, what are you seeing as far as what they're learning?
I've been doing these kinds of projects over a number of years, and one of my premises is that a way into knowledge is, or a way to process knowledge, is through art. So kids learn about nature and ecology and interconnectivity in the natural world and our place within it. And that they learn about those things, and then they make art about them, and that helps kind of make the knowledge theirs. I'm sure we've all seen people walking down the street with their cell phones and never sort of noticing what's going on around them, whether it's the plants, listening to the birds. So I hope that maybe they are a little bit more aware of the plants around them, and that they notice them and look at them and think, what kind of flower is that or tree? I would be thrilled if they came away and said, I want to learn more. That's really the most important thing, is that it sort of opens the door and they go, oh, there's a whole world out there of green stuff and plants and animals, and I want to learn more and see more.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Anne Rosenthal is an artist who teaches the after-school Luna program in Pittsburgh. That's where kids learn about urban nature through art. And they're having their very first public art show in a couple of weeks. Find out more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Another way kids can learn about the environment is to experience it directly through volunteering. That's how Aisha Hughes discovered the great outdoors and, to her surprise, liked it. Hughes led work crews in the Urban Eco Stewards program when she was an Allegheny Front intern and City Charter High School student in Pittsburgh. Volunteers adopt sections of public parks to pull out invasive plants. Here are her reflections about that experience.
When I initially joined Urban Eco Stewards, it was just to get out of class. It wasn't until our first visit to our site, the Panther Hollow Watershed, that my feelings really began to change. Our first crew outing was in February, so as you can imagine, the weather was pretty bad. But we still decided to take our monthly trip. While there, we girdled invasive Norway maples on the snowy hills surrounding the Panther Hollow Lake. Girdling, or ring barking, is when strips of bark are removed from trees using small gun-shaped tools with edges that shave away or girdle the bark. We did this to kill off the invasive Norway maples and to make room for native plants. I really like girdling with the Eco Stewards, but even this didn't make me see the importance of helping the environment. What really helped me was just taking out time to actually look at all the things the park had to offer. One of the things Eco Stewards do in just about every trip is journaling. Crew members scatter around their site to write not only about the day's activities, but also to reflect on their personal feelings of simply being in the park. Taking this time to really stop and take in the beauty of the park helped to change my perspective about environmental sustainability. I had been to the park a lot of times when I was younger, but like most kids my age, I would rather be indoors spending time on the computer, at the mall, reading, sleeping, or watching TV. Looking back now, this is why many of my fellow crew members and I just couldn't get the importance of helping to improve the environment. In our cultural literacy class, we are learning about the famous Taoist philosopher Lao Tzu. One of Lao Tzu's most famous quotes is, "A well frog cannot conceive of the ocean." This basically means that a frog that spends all of its life in a hole could never truly grasp the concept of an ocean that it has never seen. In many ways, we Eco Stewards were kind of like the well frogs from Lao Tzu's quote. Many of us hadn't been to the park or any green areas around the city for years, so the importance of keeping them around for future generations wasn't important to us. It wasn't until we actually experienced and saw the beauty of the park with our own eyes that we were able to understand its significance. I was able to realize that green spaces, which aren't that common in urban areas, are very important to sustain. Being an Eco Steward gives me the chance to give back to my community and help sustain the city's green areas for future generations, which is why I enjoy doing it so much.
That was former Allegheny Front intern Aisha Hughes in an essay she wrote a few years ago. She's about to graduate from the University of Pittsburgh with a major in Africana Studies. She says she wants to help young people become great global citizens. And to do that, they'll need to know how to enjoy and protect the environment. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer and kid at heart. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.